Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Because you know, it's such a tainted part of the history of wrongful convictions.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of time that was spent with that. Yeah.
Oh, that breaks my heart.
Okay, we're getting ready to go live. Hold.
Okay.
Stand by. Okay, good people, this is Jamala Rogers, your host, Voices from the Battlefield. My intro music is not working today, so we are going to Sean. The music is just the enhancer, it's not the essential part of that. So, yeah, there's been a lot going on, but you know, this is a time that I remind you that we still have a 34-count felon in the White House, twice impeached, a pathological liar, who is taking the world economy to the brink. And so the world is watching us to see what we're going to do about this, you know, man that wants to be a dictator. But I say for us in this country, this is not spectator sport. We actively got to be trying to do something to slow him down, stop him by any means necessary. And I know we've been doing that best we could, but we need to raise the ante, because every day, y'all, and you know this, there's something new that has been done to help dismantle the piece of democracy that we do have. And so we need to be forever vigilant. And this show, Voices from the Battlefield, is about all the different battlefields we're fighting on, both local, national, and international, and connecting all the struggles, because they are part of a bigger struggle. And sometimes we feel isolated. This is only happening to us. No, no, no. The same enemies are everywhere, you know, not just raising mischief, but they are being very destructive, culturally, morally, politically, socially. It's all right in front of us. And so I know it's easy to get demoralized, but people are fighting back, y'all. You know, you look at these elections that have happened, people have overturned it, even Democrats. You're tired and sick and tired of being sick and tired, I know. And so people are moving in that direction. But, you know, on a positive note, there was a fantastic weekend. It was the Mill Creek Valley weekend, because, A, this is the end of the exhibit at the History Museum. So if you didn't get in there to see it, I am sorry for you. But there was also an accompanying Mill Creek play written by Kathy Gamble. It was a sold out crowd, y'all, but guess what? They're going to add another one in a couple of weeks. So I will let you know about that as soon as it happened. But it was just a beautiful weekend with that. I did give my blood. You all know I'm very concerned about, you know, our friends that are dealing with sickle cell. So I met a new friend, little 7-year-old Janaya, who this particular blood drive was for. So you all got to hear a few months ago from Suni, who's 60-ish, and from Naya, who's 30-ish. So now I got a little one, y'all. So it's a span of generations that we need to be concerned about anytime we get blood. And don't be a chicken. It's very simple. It's very easy. It's quick. Think about some faces, and that's what I do. I think about Suni, Naya, and now little Janaya, 70 years old, who's still dealing with sickle cell anemia. So, yeah, so we got to do what we can, give wherever we can in many ways that we can. So this is, we get ready to move to a very important subject that's almost every day in the news in some kind of ugly way. But we have somebody that can help us navigate that, and that is none other than Kika Matos. And Kika currently is the head of the National Immigration Law Center, but she has done a number of things. She has worked on death penalty cases. She is a an attorney, so that means she's all up in that stuff, trying to make it be right for us. But she's also given leadership to organizations like the Vera Institute, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Center for Community Change, Amnesty International, and she was even the deputy mayor of New Haven, Connecticut. So she's bringing all that experiences and skills to being an advocate, a community organizer, and a powerful attorney for community defense. And so I have I'm just speechless in terms of all that she's done. And Kika, saludos, welcome to Voices from the Battlefield.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamala. And let me just say what a joy it is to be in community with you and how much love and respect I have for you and how fondly I remember our collective fights.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And it's always good to be in community with a kick-ass sister. So, yeah, definitely. And I did that introduction in that way, Kika, because I work with young people, when you're in this movement, sometimes you might have a plan, but you get an assignment. And you have to be ready for those assignments. So I named all those things because you probably, your plan was, I'm going to work for this, I'm going to work for them, and then I'm going to do this. It's been like a road that's about human rights, but it's taken different faces and different places. And so all it does is strengthen your commitment to this struggle and also give you some additional tools and expertise around it. So, yeah, so it's a lot, but I hope it wasn't too overwhelming. And I know you're a modest person, so I said, I know she's going to like, well, what she had to say all of that. But yeah, we need to connect how people move through these spaces fighting for the same thing but in different ways. So so my first question is going to be, did you check with Bad Buddy to make sure I'm on the guest list for his last show next week?
I checked for you and me. Other man is not getting my texts and my emails.
I thought it was just me. No. I thought I'm like, this is the last of the world tour. I gotta be there. Help me out, brother.
I have so wanted to go to one of his concerts. You have no idea. So yeah, I am not giving up, Jamala. I'm gonna keep trying until he comes through for us.
Yeah, well, you got one more week. The last show is next week, the 22nd. Yeah. So yeah, we gotta like get some smoke signals out, some drum beats or something to that brother so he can hear us. Yeah.
The alternative though is for him to do a concert for racial justice and immigrant rights causes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we know he won't do it here, but still, maybe we can go somewhere. So that was a little fun question, but I'm going to get to the serious stuff now. Because I know Bad Buddy ain't thinking about no Jamala Rogers in St. Louis. So he's got 80,000 people in Spain that he's been like, oh, yeah, it's been just phenomenal watching like him do his thing. But yeah. I've been asking my guests this year, like, these folks are celebrating the 250th anniversary of this country, and however you came here and however you've lived here is very different in terms of observation and celebration. And so for you who self-identifies as an Afro-Boricua, what does that mean for you? And then looking at all of those struggles that you've been a part of, how should people of African descent be looking at this particular time and space and place in the 250-year continuum?
Thank you for asking that question. Look, I think, while talk about bad timing and a missed opportunity. And bad timing because, for me, this should have been a moment of reckoning and of asking the fundamental question of has this country truly pursued the things that were contained in the Declaration of Independence and the goals that this, that were foundational to this nation: equality, due process, government by consent, right? To me, one of the ways that you test a democracy is how it treats its most vulnerable and most marginalized. This was a moment of reckoning to ask, how far have we really, how much progress have we made? How far have we gone? And also to look at the historic contributions of Black folks and immigrants, right? People who built this country and have largely not been given credit for the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that we have poured into the making of this nation. And the 250th anniversary comes during a time. So not only have we not done that, but it has happened during a time when the administration in power is doing everything it can to dismantle our democracy and to bring about authoritarianism. And so I am completely bewildered. And so what are we seeing? Performative patriotism that only targets the people that they care about. And I find it deeply ironic that when we should really be using this opportunity to ask the difficult questions and to also create a set of goals for the next 250th. Where have we failed and what do we need to do right? By whom? We are, many of us right now are doing everything we can to protect a really fragile democracy.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you yourself are the daughters of immigrant parents here, and I'm just wondering for those folks in Puerto Rico who are a colony of this damn country, how did they observe the 250th anniversary? Was it a mixed bag, kind of like it was here, or did people
Listen,
wave their flags and?
people on the island are struggling with no water, no electricity, basic necessities, and a constant question about our identity on the island, right? Puerto Rico, for all intents and purposes, is a colony. At what point in time do we get our independence, and what might that look like? So I do not believe that. This feels, I think, for many Puerto Ricans, as somewhat remote because we're neither a state nor are we independent. So what role do Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico have in this particular moment in history? And I think it depends on how you see yourself, but most, other than very wealthy Puerto Ricans, most people on the island are really struggling with basic infrastructure and basic needs.
Yeah, that sounds par for the course. And I'm thinking, just before 4th of July, I had written some stuff, but then I actually saw how Black folks were responding, both in my family and people across the country that were friends. And this one just didn't feel like previous ones. People like Mike, get their red, white, and blue outfits on and, throw some stuff on the grill. But people were just, they were just like livid about where we are right now with this particular president. And I think in many ways, Kika, they felt the same way that this really should have been a reckoning of like, where do we go from here for the next 250? What have we not done right that we can start to rectify? And instead, it's like wrecking the little bit of vestiges of justice that we had. They pretty much have torn up the Constitution, so if we don't have due process for immigrants, it won't be long before there's no due process for any of us.
The
And
rest of
so,
us. That's their plan. I see it so clearly because I'm in this space. And since this administration came into power, I've been one of those people ringing the alarm bell saying, you know what? They're starting with immigrants, but they're not going to end with immigrants. Eventually, they're going to come after all of us. So even if you don't care about immigrants, even if you don't think about immigration issues, you should pay attention because they are dismantling, they're demonizing immigrants, they're taking away immigrant rights. And the way that we know authoritarianism works is that they demonize a set of people, they start with them, and then they come for the rest of us.
And it's no accident they're usually somebody of color. So
Oh.
yeah, because they always have been painted as the other that really
Right.
don't belong, and that's where this whole citizenship thing is going. So tell us a little bit about the national, the international center that is dealing with immigrants. What, I mean, you all must be inundated with all kind of stuff right now. How are you navigating this particular point in history as immigrants are under complete attack all kinds of ways, and people are seeing that from from Minnesota to Maine, that these folks are vicious and they are killing people with no seems like with no impunity. And so what is the role of your organization right now, and how has it changed from maybe 5, 10 years ago?
Sure. So the National Immigration Law Center is almost 50 years old, and the mission of the organization is to fight for the rights and opportunities of low-income immigrants. We're essentially a law firm, but what makes us different is that we have what we call our strategic framework that really lays out how we see the role of movement lawyers. What is our theory of the case? I strongly believe in that strategic framework because it says that in order for NILC, the National Immigration Law Center, that's our acronym, to be effective, we have to do three things and we have to do them well. The first is we have to fight for just laws and policies, right? What are the laws and policies that benefit and protect immigrants in this country? The second is we can't just do that. We know, right, that we have to change hearts and minds, and that in order for us to bring about the kind of world that we want to see, we have to use narrative and culture. And so part of what we focus on also is figuring out how we change hearts and minds by telling stories, by using culture, by using stories. Because let's be honest, the most brilliant legal brief that we could write is not going to change the heart and mind of somebody in the South who feels some kind of way about immigrants, right? So we think about how we tell the stories of immigration and immigrants, and how we, when we litigate or we focus on issues, who do we bring in to help us tell the story? And then the third piece is movements, right? If you look at this nation's history, there has not been a single significant social justice accomplishment that has not been fueled by movements. From the abolition of slavery to the civil rights movement to women's right to vote to marriage equality, all of those huge accomplishments were always fueled by movements led by the people most impacted. So we work really closely with grassroots immigrant rights organizations, and we never ever take on a case or take on an issue without deeply consulting grassroots organizations. So that is the way that we approach things, and that's what makes us different from a lot of other law firms, right? Civil rights law firms, organizations that do this work. We are really deeply enmeshed in movement. What have we done in the last few years? I'll say this. Look, I came in, I've been at NILC now for 3.5 years. And the year before the elections, at the last board meeting that we had in December, my board said, "Hey, what are you doing about the elections?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Look, the elections are coming up. They're going to be really consequential. We need to have a plan in place." And I thought, "Oh, geez, I hadn't thought about that." So that meeting was in December. In January of 2024, I said to everybody in the organization, we're going to do a strategic plan, and it's going to be really based on two scenarios. What do we do under a Harris administration, and what do we do under a Trump administration? And so the entire organization's mandate was to do scenario planning. We ended up taking 10 months doing scenario planning. And I'll be honest with you, most of the time that we did scenario planning, we spent it on a Trump administration. Why? Because of Project 2025 and their really, really radical anti-immigrant agenda that they wanted to advance because of Stephen Miller's America First. He was busy for 4 years, carving out what we are seeing a really evil plan that really centered immigration. And then we heard the nonsense from Trump about Haitians eating dogs, about Mexicans being criminals. Threats to take away people's rights and to bring about authoritarianism in all sorts of ways. And at the end of 10 months, the senior staff and I met in DC at our offices, and we put up a spreadsheet because we were trying to figure out of all of the threats that he was making and all of the policy things that Project 2025 wanted to accomplish, what were the ones that we would uniquely be suited to do? And then at that point in time, when I looked at the spreadsheet, because we put it up on a slide, I thought, oh my God, I know what this is. And I said to my staff, do you see what the plan is, and they looked at me blankly. I said, it is authoritarianism. This administration, if they win, they're going to dismantle our democracy on the backs of immigrants. Why did I say that? Because they wanted to do things, we knew that they were coming, like using an executive order to change the Constitution. First, we all know that's not how you change a Constitution. And secondly, something as fundamental as birthright citizenship that is part of the Black freedom struggle. That was one of the first things they had in mind, right? We're just going to do away with birthright citizenship. They were talking about invoking a law called the Alien Enemies Act that is only invoked during wartime in order to deport immigrants without any due process rights. Right. And so we looked at this and we thought, oh my. And that's when I said to the people at NILC, we're going to have to show up differently. And we stood up this initiative that we're calling the Defending Democracy Initiative that has us at the intersection of defending our democracy and fighting for immigrant rights because we can't separate the two. And part of what I've been saying to people is authoritarianism is coming and it's coming on the backs of immigrants. And we have to all step it up because this. The only way we're going to save our democracy is by fighting back, all of them.
And obviously, NILC is one group out of probably many across the country, but they are not all law centers. Some of them deal with rapid responses. So I'm thinking, how does that landscape look in terms of the offensive of the groups directly involved in that? And then, we'd like to say that they're allies to those groups, but what does that network look like?
Yeah, look, I'll say the first thing is I want to be really clear-eyed about the fact that we are all having to fight back against an administration that has made immigration one of its key agenda items in the worst possible ways, and that they are hell-bent on trampling on people's constitutional rights and unleashing an agency, ICE, that has not been held to account whatsoever. And they have billions of dollars to play with. Just recently, they gave, in addition to over $100 billion last year, they gave ICE another $70 billion this year just for immigration enforcement. So we are clear-eyed that we're up against an administration with unlimited resources and no regard for people's constitutional rights and an absolute contempt for immigrants and particularly immigrants of color. And so we have had to be really strategic. And there is a strong set of networks, including one called FIRM, the Fair Immigration Reform Movement, which is the largest network of immigrant rights organizations around the country. And they come together to share strategies at the state level, but also to fight for immigration reform at the federal level because of the laws, right? Only the federal government can pass immigration laws. You can't do it at the state or at the local level. So there are a number of networks, and then there's United We Dream that's fighting for the rights of dreamers. So there are some coalitions, and we have been in, and NILC is in, we have a formal partnership with FIRM, and then we've coordinated with other organizations in the immigration space. So on the litigation front, for example, we talked to the ACLU, we talked to the Center for Constitutional Rights, we talked to other Democracy Forward, we talked to organizations that are litigating to say, hey, what are you doing so that we are not at cross purposes and we're not all running to litigate the same case. And so there's some level of coordination and there are tables that have been set up to try to coordinate this work. But is there a deeply coordinated, well-resourced national strategy? There is not. We do what we can with what we have. And state-level organizations are the ones that in my mind, have the most opportunity to be able to, in friendly states, not in red states, but in blue states, stand up mechanisms to protect immigrants. And so the way that we look at it is what do we have to do to fight the federal government, but also what opportunities are there at the state and local level? So, for example, in a red state, there may be some blue cities where organizations can stand up ordinances and laws to protect immigrants.
Wow. If you're just joining us here live streaming on Facebook, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And we're talking to Kika Matos, who is head of the National Immigration Law Center, and really giving us some insight about the what I would call the Goliath of all of the federal agencies. This agency, ICE, has gotten more money than any other department outside of the Pentagon itself. And so they have very deep pockets. And then I'm thinking about the number of nonprofits who are on the battlefield trying to do this, who are being defunded for various reasons. And it just seems like it's an impossible task, but people are making headway. I think about the folks who are devising, say, for example, in Minneapolis, a support system for immigrants that even includes doing their grocery shopping, because people are so fearful now even going out. And I'm not even talking about people who are, quote, don't have the, quote, right paper. I'm talking about even people who have, because as we know, and I'm going to ask you about this in a minute, Kika, like people who are out here trying to make a living, trying to do what they are, these folks don't know a Haitian from a Ethiopian. So you, everybody's going to get be part of the sweep. But what are the consequences, both right now and in the near future, of the harm that ICE is doing? Because it seems like even some of the AGs, the attorney generals who are doing their own investigations, like in Minnesota, are having difficulty of getting evidence, getting cooperation from the federal government. Now, I just think that what the times we're living in are so unprecedented. Like you're literally fighting your government, who is harming its own citizens. It seems like it's just a really messed up situation. But I've seen people like do stuff. They are vigilant about like where ICE is showing up. They got apps on the phone, so people are doing stuff. Tell us a little bit about what it looks like in New Haven for immigrants. And as you said, one of the things that people don't understand is how many immigrants are amongst us. And I know we tend to look at only immigrants coming from Mexico, but they're from all over the world. And I've had immigrants talking about their situations. Many of them have been in this country for a very long time. The last ones we had were Haitians, and they talked about what it's been like, and that the fear of what Trump was going to do, including like the temporary the
Protective status.
TPRs. So if you would, as you're talking about these different situations in New Haven and how you all have responded, tell us about the different statuses, because I think that's ignorance on our part as citizens. Like, who's here and why? How long they get to stay? Because I see what they're doing is lumping everybody together. Because either you got papers or you don't, and if you don't have the right papers, whatever that is supposed to mean, then you're going to be deported. So, students, TPRs, H-1Bs, what kind of status do people have here when they come?
Yeah, I'll start there and then work backwards because I think one of the things that folks need to understand is the tactics that the administration is engaging in are some of them are just straight up unconstitutional and they don't seem to care. And they have engaged in a campaign of terror and have unleashed, particularly ICE, a lot of violence in Black and Brown communities. And they are counting on the possibility that people don't know what their constitutional rights are. And so a lot of what we've been doing is making sure people know what their rights are. But they're also gaslighting Americans and grooming us to the idea that it's somehow normal to have the military on our streets. And we saw how ICE did that, right? They deployed the military in Chicago, in LA, in Minneapolis, in parts of Maine, in LA, a bunch of different blue cities, right? And engaged in this kind of, they both militarized communities and then engaged in violence that they didn't even hide, right? Violence on the streets. But let me back up and start off with a basic question, which I think a lot of people ask, which is why are there so many undocumented people in this country? Why can't they just get in line and fix their status? The simple answer is there is no line to get on. We have an immigration system that is deeply broken.
It has been for a while.
For a while, the last time there was any comprehensive change in federal law around immigration, because you can only touch immigration if you're the federal government, was in 1986 when Ronald Reagan granted amnesty, right? That is how broken our system is. And then there's a level of complicity on the part of the government, because when there's a shortage of workers, people look the other way. We need people to come and do the work, right? We'll be a little permissive. We'll look the other way. And then when the economy tanks, all of a sudden they blame it on immigrants. It's those undocumented immigrants, and they're taking up American jobs. But fundamentally, we have a broken system, and then there are very few ways that people can actually get status in this country. You mentioned some of them. So how do people come to this country? They come on worker visas, like the H-1B visa. They come on student visas. There's also our system of immigration largely also is family dependent. And so the people who are able to sponsor family members. So if you're an immigrant and you get US citizenship, you can then sponsor to have other family members come in. So our system of immigration is largely a family-based system of immigration. Then there are things like asylum and refugee status. So the asylum laws are both US-based and internationally based. And they were created after the horrors of World War II, right? When so many Jewish people were turned away, including in the United States, right? They came on a boat and the US said, we don't want them. And after World War II, people said, never again. And so asylum is this idea that if you step foot on US soil and you claim that you are being persecuted for a number of reasons, your religion, your politics, a set of criteria about how your gender identity, you can claim asylum, and then you start the process in the United States. Refugee status, you apply for it overseas, and then the government vets you, and then you're able to come in. And then the TPS, which you mentioned, which is temporary protected status. And that was created in 1990 by the government. And the purpose of TPS is to be able to give people status who are undocumented in this country because they can't go home. And the reason they can't go home is because their country it has faced some terrible catastrophe or is largely unstable. So think about the earthquake in Haiti, for example, and think about the fact that Haiti is really a collapsed society, right? It has very little civic infrastructure left. And TPS has the TPS was granted to 17 countries, and it's not permanent, but it can be renewed. So those are some of the ways that you can get status in this country. That's it. So if you're somebody who overstays your visa or you cross the border and you're undocumented, there is very little that you can do to regularize your status. Oh, and then there's something called diversity visas, which was a way to make sure that people from the African continent and the Caribbean, right? I.e., let me put in brackets, Black immigrants would be able to come to the United States. Now, since this administration has come into power, they are trying to do away with TPS. That's the case that went to the Supreme Court and was decided a few weeks ago. And the administration said the government can decide when to end TPS. They can make whatever policies, which means that now Haitians and Syrians, TPS has been stripped. There are a number of countries that, when their TPS comes up for renewal, more likely than not, this administration is going to say, no, we're going to end TPS for you too. The diversity visas have been suspended. The government said, no, we're going to suspend it. And they waited for some shooting by somebody who allegedly had TPS, had diversity, who had come in under a diversity visa. And the administration said, No, we're doing away with the diversity visa. There was something called humanitarian parole that targeted people from Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua and a number of countries. One of the first things this administration said, we're going to do away with humanitarian parole. And they have shut the border down and really made it difficult for anyone to step foot in this country to claim asylum. And that was another Supreme Court opinion that recently hit, where the Supreme Court said, actually, no, you need to actually be in this country, not in the Mexican border, but in this country before you can claim asylum. And then in terms of refugees, usually the government will say, we're going to take X number of refugees from the country. And under this administration, the numbers have dropped. And the only people this administration was willing to welcome as refugees were white South Africans.
Right, and what's wrong with that picture? I'm thinking as you were talking, and this is another aspect that I think needs to be part of our educating of the public, and that is the people who are coming here, particularly those who are seeking asylum, are doing so because of U.S. foreign policies in their country. So even when you talk about Haiti, I mean, the U.S. has been bashing Haiti ever since Toussaint won against the French, and so they have made sure that that country will never be sovereign. And maybe it will be sometime after I'm dead and gone. But as you said, there's hardly any infrastructure left. I mean, there's plenty of national corporations that are exploiting the labor and land. I mean, really, it's really sad what's going to happen, what is happening. And so when you think about Haiti, and you said, we're going to send you back. And these Haitians are saying, to what? You all have completely like dismantled, and you got thugs running around here, controlling different parts of the country. What are we supposed to go back to? And basically, it's like, we don't care what's there. We don't care what we've done to destabilize your country. You're not staying here. It's kind of like when you're out at the club and they turn those lights off at one. You don't have to go home, but you ain't staying here. Yeah.
And here's part of the absolute hypocrisy of this administration. When the former DHS secretary announced that they were going to no longer to remove TPS for Haitians, she said that everything's fine. These people don't need TPS anymore. They can go back to Haiti, right? That's the DHS wing of the government. The State Department, in the meantime, has statements about Haiti saying people shouldn't travel to Haiti. It is really, 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 really dangerous. So what is it? That people are safe and they don't need TPS anymore? Or is it the State Department, right, whose job it is to know what's going on in these different countries to say it is absolutely dangerous? Let me be really clear. We are going to be so they've removed the status of 350 people. Some of them will die when they go back to Haiti. And in fact, in the brief that went before the Supreme Court around TPS, they told a story of, I believe it was two women who returned to Haiti and were decapitated within a matter of almost immediately after they returned back to Haiti. There is nothing but suffering and danger to many of the people that were protected by getting TPS status. And the thing that I think a lot of people also don't understand is that some people have had TPS for decades, right? 15 years. TPS was stood up in 1990. So you've been living in this country now for 10, 15 years. You have a job. You have protection from deportation. You start a family here in this country. And then from one day to the next, you're told you can't be here anymore. You have to go back. Go back to a country you haven't been to in 15 years to do what exactly? To live where? With whom? And this is a collapsed regime. How do you start to live your life with so much instability and so much violence around you? There are parts of Haiti that are run by gangs. That's what I find so horrifying about this government's policies.
It's heartbreaking. It's horrifying, but it's heartbreaking too, because can you imagine the kind of discussions these families are having about what they're going to do? Where are they going to go? I mean, so I know that in some cases, even with other nationalities, they are basically just trying to go underground and be quiet. And some of them even quote self-deporting, but in Haiti, that's not even a issue. It's not even a relevant issue. And so for us, the ones of us in this country who are supposed to have some level of civility, we ought to be outraged about what this country is doing in that regard. So not only are they extracting labor, stealing minerals, doing whatever, doing change regime based on the CIA, they are doing havoc all over these countries. And then when these people seek refuge here, then they want to say no. And then they've gotten some of us to buy into it, like, no, don't come in here taking our jobs. Well, you all took our whole damn land. What are you talking about?
You ruined it for us, right? You made it impossible for us to live in our country because of your foreign policies, and now we're saying you can't come live in our country either.
Right. I mean, it just does not make sense, and that's why I think it's this question for now and for a while will be very important because it's connected to a lot of different issues. If we don't see that the erasure of civil rights for immigrants, then it won't be long before you'll be fighting. And people have found out if they get caught up in these stings, it does take a minute for them to validate who they are. And so citizenship for most of us is tenuous. I remember when I had dreadlocks, folks thought I was something else, and of course I would be the one snatched out of the line at the airport for a random check. That
Random
was
in
random
quotes.
checks, and I'm like, yeah, right, random. And so to me, all of us are at risk, and so it's up to us to really start making sure that our Constitution is not only enforced, but nothing happens to it, because this man is like erasing stuff, either by edict or by practice. And so it's a very scary time for immigrants, but it should be a scary time for all of us. One of the things I keep thinking about, Kika, is the people who are being deported. Now, not deported, detained, and I call them concentration camps. They're not just detention, they're concentration camps of the 21st century. And so there are things going on in those places that are not just inhumane, but also illegal. And so that's why it's been difficult to get in there and see. And there's been Congress people who try to get in there, and they, even when they get there, they clean it up a bit. But we know there's some horrendous stuff going on. And you and I know a little bit about the U.S. prisons and what's inside because we've had to fight in some of the, for some of those conditions to be improved for both individual prisoners, but also as a class, those prisoners. So this. These folks got a whole different thing going on at the detention center. And I just recently read about the underage girls that are coming up pregnant. And so they're being sent to a particular facility in Texas. And, so these things, I keep telling, always reminding us that these things are being done in our name with our money. And so we have to be aware, but the conditions that are there, some group like NILC, whose law, because the rest of us, we can be outside protesting, but the law and taking these characters to court and getting some remedy there is not in our toolbox. What can be done about those conditions inside? I mean, people are not getting medication, they're barely getting fed, and when they do, it's bad food. I mean, they are really trying to make these people regret that they are never going to come to this country if they get released. And so yeah, it seems like punishment on top of punishment on top of punishment.
So let me say a couple of things about that. First, I just want to say the word detention centers is a polite euphemism for what in essence are jails and prisons, right? In fact, some jails that have been emptied out, right, have been replaced by immigrants. And so I'm very clear to say to people, I've been to detention centers and I have been to death rows. There is no difference as far as I
No,
can see
none.
the two of them. And the people who are in detention centers are being held there because they lack status. That's it. They haven't committed a crime, right? violent or nonviolent. And not just that, but this administration is so cruel and so awful that one of the things that they did in order to try to get at what you mentioned, which is to get people to self-deport, is they reinterpreted the immigration laws such that they said, okay, now we're going to say that everybody who is undocumented is somebody who has entered without an inspection, right? Which is a status that then they argue allows the administration to put them in detention centers, right? So what that did was it meant that anybody who's undocumented, no matter how long they have lived in the United States, now they're saying, oh, we've changed the laws, you're undocumented, and so we're just going to shove you in a detention center because you, quote unquote, entered without inspection. So it's a completely radical reinterpretation of the laws that has now then allowed them to pick people up and shove them into detention centers. And then they also wanted to deny them bond hearings. Until recently, when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, everybody's entitled to bond hearings within 90 days. They instructed immigration judges, who, by the way, are Department of Justice employees. They're not like federal judges that have independence. They told the judges, you should absolutely deny anybody a bond hearing. That is why there are 63,000 people now in detention. It's because of this new interpretation of the law. And the strategy is we'll pick everybody up who's undocumented, doesn't matter how long they've been in this country for, and we're going to shove them in detention centers. And then we'll make sure that the conditions are so terrible, right? And we'll make sure that they have no hope at all, right? Because you don't know how long they're going to be there, therefore, that the only thing that they could think about is getting out of there. So that is really what has happened. Now, the other thing to remember is that these detention centers are run by corporations. Cha-ching is the bottom line. And so that is why also the conditions are so terrible. Why give somebody a healthy salad for dinner that'll cost you $5 when you can give them a moldy sandwich that'll cost you 25 cents? So the conditions are terrible, and many of these for-profit corporations don't care. Because their bottom line is how much of a profit can we make off the misery of immigrants?
And the other thing, Kika, their contracts were based on you're going to provide us with so many bodies on a daily basis. And when that wasn't happening, they were like, whoa, 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 you're in breach of your contract. So now we keep hearing this number of 10,000 a day that these folks need to be out on the street. So I'm not surprised that it's now up to, what do you say, 63,000 people?
63,000. And then, the previous DHS secretary spent millions and millions of dollars buying warehouses all over the country to warehouse immigrants. The new DHS secretary has some other plan up his sleeve. So they've decided that they're going to abandon this idea of warehousing immigrants, not for any reason other than protests. People said, not in my backyard. I don't want these warehouses. I don't want these to be places of misery where immigrants are going to be warehoused.
And that's the thing that I think has been important in illuminating that people have to stand up where they are for whenever they can, and they have had to abandon these plans. I know in Kansas City, the mayor said moratorium for 5 years. As long as I'm mayor, you're not bringing any of that here. And then folks have been successful in other places where they bought, big warehouses and thinking they were going to just be detaining people and housing people. But I'm just thinking, what is the, do we have any recollection or record of who is in there, where they are, and what's happening? So people are actually dying in those places. So are their families being notified? What's happening with them? And I'm thinking about these underage girls, some as young as 13, that are getting pregnant. Like, what is happening to their babies when they have them? And who knows what's going on in these places?
I'll start off by giving you a really terrible number, which is that since this administration came into power of January of last year, 52 people have died in detention.
That we know of.
Yes, that we know of. One of the most recent ones of a few weeks ago was an 85-year-old German national. Why in God's green earth would you think it appropriate to detain somebody who's 85 years old and keep them there? And he died. There was also recently a gentleman from Afghanistan who fought alongside the US for 10 years, and he was applying for asylum, and he was detained and put in a detention center, was given something that caused an allergic reaction, and the next day he was dead. This man had six children. Now, when ICE came to pick him up, they detained him and arrested him in front of his six children. And so there was a significant number of deaths in detention, which is a huge problem and a headache for this administration, not because they're concerned about these deaths as much as that it is making them look bad. And the conditions of confinement are terrible. And like you said, members of Congress had to fight to get access to these detention centers, and they're often slow walked. Right. Once they had their fight, we said, we have every right to be able to inspect government property that we fund. These detention centers also, like you say, they duck and weave and they slow walk because they don't want members of Congress to see the conditions under which people are living. The really terrible thing is there is a database that is a government database where you should be able to see if somebody is in detention. So they ask you to enter the person's name and a bunch of ways to identify them. And if they've been detained, they should be in the system. So you should be able to get notice that Mr. X was picked up and he is at, say, Adelanto Detention Center in California. But the terrible thing is that the government does not do a good job of keeping up with people who've been detained. So often, the information is inaccurate because they just haven't kept it up. So families are often panicked because a loved one disappears, or they get a call saying, "Hey, I saw your brother being picked up or shoved in." The other thing that people, I think, don't know enough about that came out in this, the man who was shot in Houston last week, is ICE is picking people up. And when they pick people up, it's in unmarked cars. And sometimes they're not even wearing uniform. So imagine you are minding your business, driving down the street, and an unmarked car follows you. And you stop at a red light, and these people get out of their cars and they come for you and they drag you out. That is what is happening. And people often don't know, including this man in Houston who was shot, who are these people in this
Right.
unmarked car? And why are they dragging me out of my car? And often they wear these mass, right? Picked up and then they're shut, they're taken to detention centers. And families often they will hear, "I saw your brother was kidnapped," or their loved one doesn't come home. And then they're trying frantically trying to figure out what in God's what the hell happened to my loved ones. And one of the things that you should be able to do is to go to the government website and see that person has been detained, but often they're not even there. So it takes a phone call when the person's actually finally able to make a phone call, that loved ones find out where the loved ones are. And I will say this about immigration, too, Jamal, is that often people who don't know or think much about immigration think about immigrants as living isolated lives. But the truth of the matter is that there are millions of people who live in this country, that are known as quote unquote mixed status families. And what that means is that it is a family where one or more person who's undocumented lives with them, but people start families and start relationships. And so when someone is detained or deported, what often happens is if a family separation that impacts US citizens, there are over 5 million kids who have at least one undocumented parent in this country.
Yeah, I'm also thinking, Kika, just by listening to you, is that oftentimes when you say we don't really recognize them because they're so integrated into our communities, they are, the shopkeeper, they are doing the blood test at the hospital, and they may not have an accent because they've been here a while, or they might be second generation. And so when people look and they're looking at like the stereotypical immigrant, and I'm like, no, they're gonna be your neighbors, the folks at church. I mean, they're gonna be people that you didn't even know were like, part Haitian, or sometimes they get mixed up with like who looks like a light-skinned black person.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, absolutely. Locally, when I remember one time I had a meeting with one of the biggest pastors of African American church where I live, and I was trying to get him to speak out on behalf of immigrants, and he said, "But I don't, that's not my community. I don't know anyone who's an immigrant." And I said, "But you should care because they're immigrants who live in the city." And he wasn't hostile, but he was saying to me lovingly, "That's not my community. Don't pull me in." Jamala, 6 months later, he came into my office and he said, "I need to talk to you." And he said, "I need your help because turns out that one of my congregants is from Trinidad and she was beat by ICE." It's what you
And
say, you don't know.
it's probably more than that at his church. He
Yes.
probably should have just put out a call
Yes.
after church, come to my office if you know, so we'll know the breadth of the problem that we need
Yes.
to be wrapping our heads around.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a
But
wake-up call for him. I think he realized, wow, it really does affect me and my community.
yeah. And so in the few minutes that we have left, I'm just, it seems again so overwhelming because these people have deep pockets. They are spending money like drunken sailors because they what else are they going to do with it?
Yes.
Using it to abuse us in the name of, and I say us because these people are part of our families, some of them, they're part of our communities. What is the couple of things that you wish people would do more of when it comes to this whole question of immigration?
Everybody needs to speak out. Everybody needs to be a part of our democracy. I am sure that there are local immigrant rights organizations all over Missouri. People should look for them and sign up. Inevitably, in every community, what are you likely to see? A rapid response
Offer help.
network, a group of immigrant rights organizations that are coordinating volunteer work. Because some immigrants now are too afraid to even do the grocery shopping. And there are people who are volunteering saying, "Oh, I'll do the
Exactly.
grocery shop," or people who have to go to court and there's accompaniment. And then there are in different places things that are known as walking school buses, where parents volunteer to walk children to school to make sure that they're protected from ICE. And so what I would say to folks is Google it or ask people in your community which are the immigrant rights organizations that are doing this work and sign up.
Yeah. I it's
Africans at home and
Now
throughout
I
the
want to play the
diaspora.
intro music. So,
Africans at
yeah,
home
Kid,
and
thanks so
throughout.
much for offering your expertise. And I feel conflicted now. I thought it was going to feel lighter because you were going to give me some hope, but it now it seems to be tempered by the fact that we have so much coming at us. It's not just the immigrant issue, it's all these other things too, and that people feel like they have to pick and choose, like, what's going to be my fight today? Is it going to be to feed my family, or is it going to be to support an immigrant? And I'm saying, like, they're all part of the same issue. And so if you're talking about democracy, all of us are being impacted.
Like I say in Spanish, poner su granito de arena. Everybody has to put their little grain of salt. So I always say to people, I don't care what you do, do something.
Do
That is
something.
how we're going to protect our democracy and feel good that you are part of the fight.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, if you help to shut down one of those concentration camps, or you got somebody out of office that was anti-immigrant, anti-human, that's going to be
All of
very
that
empowering.
matters.
It matters, and it's going to be really empowering. And in the next few months, we know we got lots of work to do going to the midterms and to protect citizens' right to vote, including those folks who are immigrants and who have status, or who have U.S. citizen status, but now too scared to even go
Yes,
vote.
that's right.
So, and these folks are probably going to be showing up at our election sites because they have nothing else to do. They've also engaged local police to do their bidding, and so we got lots of work to do, Kika.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, but thank you for joining us. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Go.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
in the spirit of Umoja. Embrace with love.